Penguin Random House Audio presents The Playbook, a story of theater, democracy, and the making of a culture war by James Shapiro. Read for you by Gabra Zachman. For Anne Edelstein. Playbook. A book containing the scripts of dramatic plays. A set of tactics frequently employed by one engaged in competitive activity. American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. Preface. Like other Americans, I can rely on the federal government to send me a Social Security check once a month when I'm old or disabled. And I sleep better thanks to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, knowing that if my bank is the next to fail, my savings are still protected, even as the Securities and Exchange Commission protects my pension's investments. A century ago, these guardrails didn't exist, nor did the Federal National Mortgage Association to secure housing, the National Labor Relations Board to ensure workers' rights, the Soil Conservation Service to help farmers and protect the nation's ecosystems, or the Tennessee Valley Authority to provide natural resource planning and hydroelectric power for communities inadequately served by the private sector. These seven federal programs are the sole survivors of the New Deal legislation of the 1930s, proposed by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, then passed by Congress, over the bitter objections of vested interests, who to this day keep trying to curtail programs that protect so many. Vestiges of other New Deal projects still surround us, enriching our lives, though I suspect that few Americans are aware when hiking a trail cut on a mountainside in Colorado, or passing a vivid mural in a post office in Mississippi, or thumbing through one of the still reprinted state guides in a bookstore in Vermont. John Steinbeck called them the most comprehensive account of the United States ever got together. That these only exist because of the New Deal's Works Progress Administration. WPA. This book is about a once-thriving WPA relief program that did not survive and has left little trace. The Federal Theater Project, which from 1935 to 1939 staged, for a pittance, over 1,000 productions in 29 states seen by 30 million, or roughly 1 in 4 Americans, two-thirds of whom, according to audience surveys, had never seen a play before. It offered traditional fare, like Shakespeare, mixed in with contemporary plays on issues that mattered to Depression-era audiences, such as slum housing and the threat of fascism, topics largely shunned by Hollywood and the commercial stage. Led by a theater professor, Hallie Flanagan, it employed at its peak over 12,000 struggling artists, some of whom, like Orson Welles and Arthur Miller, would soon be famous, but most of whom were just ordinary people eager to work again at their craft. It was the product of a moment when the arts, no less than industry and agriculture, were thought to be vital to the health of the republic and deserving of its support. The Federal Theater brought entertainment to the work camps where those hiking trails were being dug. It brought children's plays on touring trucks to kids in crowded cities. It staged works in foreign languages to reach immigrants. It established what it called Negro units from Hartford to Seattle to support Black actors and playwrights. It brought free theater to asylums, orphanages, hospitals, prisons, and veterans' homes. It revived playgoing in rural states where the movies had all but ended it. 10 million listeners a week tuned into its radio broadcasts. Its popularity, which contributed to its undoing, confirmed that there was a hunger for drama that spoke to the unsettling times. The Federal Theater was the first New Deal project to be successfully attacked and abruptly terminated on the grounds that it promoted un-American activity. When it was shut down, a series of fact-based plays exploring subjects as urgent as war, flood control, food and drugs, tuberculosis, and money, as well as four others on America's racial divide, were in development. Its closing would have a lasting impact on American cultural life, and inevitably on the resilience of the nation's democracy. For the health of democracy and theater, twin born in ancient Greece, has always been mutually dependent. The consequences of the attacks on it, part of a particularly ugly culture war that led to its defunding, are still felt today. The term culture war didn't enter the national vocabulary until the summer of 1992, when Patrick Buchanan, a far-right conservative, declared at the Republican National Convention that there is a religious war going on in our country for the soul of America. It is a cultural war. Buchanan had lifted the phrase from a groundbreaking book published a year earlier, Culture Wars, The Struggle to Define America, by a sociologist of religion, James Davison Hunter. Hunter had argued that America is in the midst of a culture war, with progressives opposed by an orthodoxy who didn't like where the country was heading. Hunter saw the origins of the conflict as sectarian rather than political, the result of century-long tectonic shifts as a once overwhelmingly Protestant nation fitfully absorbed other religious groups and new coalitions emerged. His book focused on the controversies that followed from these realignments during the 1960s, especially over abortion, the arts, gay and women's rights, and what was taking place in America's classrooms. The idea that the nation was embroiled in a culture war resonated powerfully and would be a rallying cry, mostly for those on the right, in the ensuing decades. A slew of books with similar-sounding titles followed, including Andrew Hartman's A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars, Todd Gitlin's The Twilight of Common Dreams, Why America is Racked by Culture Wars, Edward P. Lazier's Culture Wars in America, Irene Tavis Thompson's Culture Wars and Enduring American Dilemmas, and Bill O'Reilly's Culture Warrior. While not necessarily sharing Hunter's religion-driven narrative, all these writers, across the political spectrum, were happy to agree with his premise that America's culture wars emerged in the late 1960s. But to accept that they began as late as that ignores the obvious. Culture wars have long divided Americans, as far back as revolutionary times, when colonists content with life under British rule were opposed by others who fought for independence. In the early decades of the Republic, fresh ones emerged between those who favored American expansionism and those who rejected manifest destiny. And then, bloodily, in a civil war between secessionists who fought to perpetuate slavery and abolitionists who opposed them. That war did not put an end to competing worldviews that would lead to fresh culture wars over Reconstruction and citizenship into the 1870s, then over populism in the 1890s, and so on. As the nation changed, so have its culture wars, which have always been with us and rarely serve as precursors to each other. The culture war that broke out in the late 1930s over the place of the arts and especially of theater in our democracy took place at a time, much like our own, of economic uncertainty, racial tensions, and rising nationalism and fascism, with new technologies transforming how entertainment and news were experienced. But there were fundamental differences, too, for it was a time framed by the Depression and the outbreak of World War II, and then a Cold War in which cultural battles were vastly overshadowed by economic and soon military ones and never reached their current fever pitch. Crucially, the 1930s were also years in which progressives in America found their voice in both the political and artistic realms, leading their opponents to seek out strategies to halt or reverse what were for them disturbing societal changes. In that respect, it anticipated our current divide. A defining legacy of this culture war is how these strategies coalesced into a right-wing playbook, widely used today, for securing power and challenging progressive initiatives. A central figure in this story is a largely forgotten congressman from East Texas, the charming, bigoted, and ambitious Martin Dies. In 1938, Dies was appointed chairman of the first congressional Un-American Committee, universally known as the Dies Committee, that was expected to look into the rise of Nazism and communism in America, and 7 months later, turn in a final report and then disband. Determined to secure a more permanent platform, Dies focused much of his committee's investigations instead on the federal theater and its playbooks, that is, its scripts, generating headlines for months. The political theater riveted the nation, and Dies's popularity soared. The result of this clash between government entities was that the federal theater was killed off in 1939, while the House Un-American Activities Committee survived until 1975. In the course of waging and winning this battle, Dies assembled that figurative playbook so pervasive, it
Sample complete. Ready to continue?